United States.
Labour markets. Oken's razor. The benefits of America's hot economy have been unevenly spread.
Our economy's on fire, says Tamara Atkinson, head of Austin's Workforce Development Board. Workers there are being fought over with signing bonuses, paid internships, and help with tuition fees. Ms. Atkinson sees formerly incarcerated workers being given second chances, with employers asking how severe their crime really was. She even worries that wages for flipping burgers are now so high that they are pulling people away from education. As Ms. Atkinson heard the economy humming, unemployment statistics revealed a blip. January's figures, published by the Texas Workforce Commission on March 8th, revealed that Austin's unemployment rate had ticked up from 2.7% in December to 3.1% in January. On the same day, the Bureau of Labour Statistics generated some sharp intakes of breath when it revealed that in February, the whole economy generated just 20,000 new jobs, far below January's bumper haul of 311,000. Both figures are probably statistical anomalies. Austin's figure was not seasonally adjusted, and average jobs growth for the country as a whole over the past 3 months has been a healthy 186,000. I wouldn't interpret this as the labour market softening, says Betsy Stevenson of the University of Michigan, the former chief economist at the Department of Labour. Rather than causing panic, these new numbers should be a reminder of both the extraordinary benefits of the recovery so far and the human cost if it falters. The particular benefits provided by a hot economy were laid out by an economist called Arthur Oken in 1973. He argued that lowering unemployment would generate benefits far beyond just creating jobs, reckoning that it would raise a submerged iceberg, pulling people off the sidelines and into work, pushing part-timers into full-time engagements, and boosting productivity. Such would be the power of a vibrant economy that it would draw people and resources towards where they could be most useful. The experience of the past decade has confirmed much of Mr. Oken's thesis. The nature of employment has shifted towards full-time jobs, and fewer people are working fewer hours than they would like. Young women have rejoined the workforce with much more enthusiasm than men. After America's disability rolls swelled during the recession, many feared that those leaving the labour force would never return. Those fears were clearly misguided, says Ernie Tedeschi, an economist at Evercore ISI, an investment bank. The share of people aged 26 to 55 saying that they are out of work because of illness or disability was lower in 2018 than it was back in 2008. The change has accounted for almost half of the increase in labour force participation over the past year. A new study presented at the Brookings Institution almost 50 years later tests Mr. Oken's thesis with data from the most recent recovery. It finds that the higher the unemployment rate is for any particular group, the more sensitive that group will be to the ups and downs of the economy. African Americans, for example, tend to have higher unemployment rates than whites, and they suffered a disproportionate share of the job losses during the recession. Notwithstanding a recent wobble, they have since enjoyed a disproportionate share of the gains. Groups with lower levels of education find themselves in a similar situation, as they too suffered a harder blow than most during the recession, and more recently have enjoyed a faster fall in their unemployment rate. For the likes of Ms. Atkinson, who worries about the people flipping burgers to pay their rent, these basic measures of success are not good enough. If a hot economy pulls people into dead-end jobs, then they will fall right back out of them when the next recession strikes. The evidence on this from Austin is mixed. According to Indeed.com, an online jobs platform, Local searches for jobs such as shop assistant, warehouse worker and waitress rose by more than 300% between the end of 2017 and the end of 2018. But searches for learning and development opportunities rose even more quickly. Nationwide, Mr. Tedeschi is not worried, pointing out that the share of people who say that they are out of work because they are in education is higher than it was in 2008 and has persistently been so. It is possible that as wage growth puts pressure on companies' profit margins, they will respond by investing in productivity-boosting measures, in line with Mr. Oaken's third prediction. Nicole Trimble of Talent Rewire, a consultant for companies trying to expand employment among disadvantaged groups, is doing a roaring trade for companies including Tyson Foods, a meat processor, and McDonald's, a fast food chain. Companies are finding they have to offer help that they used to think of as the preserve of government, such as helping workers claim tax credits or with financial literacy. Some firms are retraining existing workers when they automate, rather than firing them and hiring a new batch. Ms. Trimble doubts they would be doing all this in a cooler labour market. For all this good news, growth in Americans' labour productivity is still slow, and past experience delivers a gloomy message about the economy's capacity to redress structural inequalities. Another study by Julie Hotchkiss of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta and Robert Moore of Georgia State University found that the benefits to disadvantaged groups from hot economies have tended to be smaller than their penalties in colder times. It's not a matter of if there's going to be another recession, warns Ms. Atkinson, it's a matter of when. If February's jobs numbers turn out to be more than a hiccup, then those who have risen farthest will have farthest to fall.
United States.
Lexington. The Irish Conquest of America. This St. Patrick's Day, Irish Americans can celebrate the Blarneyfication of their democracy.
When John Hearne, Ireland's ambassador to Washington, sent Harry Truman a box of shamrocks on St. Patrick's Day in 1952, he could not have imagined he was launching the greatest exercise in soft power. Yet it is hard to think of a rival to the annual shamrock ceremony and its attendant rituals. On March 14th, Leo Varadkar, the sixth consecutive Irish Taoiseach to conduct them, will celebrate St. Patrick's Day by breakfasting with Vice President Mike Pence. He will be feted at a lunch on Capitol Hill, attended by Donald Trump. He will proceed with the President wearing a green tie, possibly on the long side, to the White House for the plant handover. They will meanwhile hold the only annually scheduled substantive talks America affords any foreign leader. This is great for Ireland. For the inconvenience of having to buy lots of green ties, the current ambassador has around 40, its representatives enjoy unrivalled access to the superpower. The notion that America might favour Britain over Ireland in any post-Brexit wrangle, a fear Mr. Varadkar is expected to raise, is untenable. Yet Ireland's soft power triumph is mainly testament to the continued enthusiasm of 32 million Irish Americans for their roots and to their equally remarkable dominance of American politics. Besides Mr. Pence, two of whose grandparents were born in Ireland, the Republican House leader, Kevin McCarthy, is Irish-American, as was his predecessor, Paul Ryan, and their Senate counterpart, Mitch McConnell. Among the many other Irish-Americans who have served Mr. Trump are his sometime advisers, Steve Bannon and Kellyanne Conway, and his current and former chiefs of staff, Mick Mulvaney and John Kelly. Mr. Mulvaney, whose daughter is studying in Dublin, helped organise a tree planting on Capitol Hill to commemorate the centenary of the Easter Rising. This is, in a sense, par for the course. Barack Obama's administration was also full of Irish Americans, including Joe Biden, his Yates-quoting deputy, who is expected to announce a presidential run shortly. Mr. Obama, get it? also promoted his own Irish ancestry, as did his five immediate predecessors. There are a few reasons for this Celtic preeminence. They include the role of the Catholic Church, the English language, and the relatively even gender balance of the 2 million Irish who came to America between 1820 and 1860. They helped keep Irish-American communities intact. The fact that many were and are in political hotspots such as Ohio and Pennsylvania also boosted their political relevance and activity. So does a propensity to talk. We do communications, politics, Italians, cook, Josh's Neil O'Dowd of Irish America magazine. Yet the most significant factor, because it says a lot about the broader state of politics, is a strong Irish-American political culture, rooted in anti-elitism, outsiderism and grievance. Generations after most Irish-Americans lost touch with the old country, it is still evident, indeed especially evident, on the right and left today. To understand this, consider that the 19th century hordes were not quite the naive starvelings they are often described as. They left a country already mobilised by nationalists such as Daniel O'Connell, whose monster meetings drew hundreds of thousands, and the heavy use Irish nationalists made of America as a rear base and source of funds through to the late 20th century nurtured that awakening. The Easter Rising was part organised in America. A lecture by Yeats drew 4,000 New Yorkers in 1904. The discrimination Irish Americans faced at home as the last whites to become white, it is sometimes said, politicised them further. Yet it is notable that Irish American politicians harped on the feeling this inspired of struggle and two fingers to the bloody establishment long after Ireland was free and most Irish Americans comfortably middle class. Ireland's chief export has been neither potatoes nor linen, but exiles and immigrants who have fought with sword and pen for freedom, enthused Bobby Kennedy. And that mutinous sentiment is as effective today, for example, to display the common touch of politicos such as Mr. Biden, as it was in launching the Fenian movement or hiding the excesses of Tammany Hall. Mr. Biden, who has spent half a century in frontline politics, expresses it by quoting his mother, Jean Finnegan. "Show me the guy that says something about you, Joey," she reportedly said. Ever since John F. Kennedy drew the votes of 80% of Irish Americans, they have been peeling off to the right. About half vote Republican now. Growing prosperity, the demise of organised labour and the union of conservative Catholics and the religious right explain this. Yet despite switching parties and objectives, their politicians retain the same old spirit and tropes. William F. Buckley, one of the founders of modern conservatism, griped about the greedy liberal elite like a dispossessed peasant intellectual. Mr. Bannon, a former investment banker who dresses like a scruffy boyo, rails against globalisation with the same resentful fury. So does the billionaire Mr. Trump, whom Mr. Bannon calls the third Irish president, despite his Scotch-German roots. The style and themes of Irish-American politics now dominate American politics. Rival Irish-Americans even sometimes express their political differences in a parallel row over authentic Irishness. The Catholic overseers of the St. Patrick's Day parade in New York barred gay Irish-Americans until recently. Progressive Irish-Americans hammer restrictionists like Mr. Bannon for betraying their migrant history. This might be considered the final stage of the Irish triumph in America, the Blarneyfication of its democracy. And as that phrase suggests, it should be viewed cautiously, because politicians like Mr. Biden and Mr. Bannon are not only resorting to a proud political tradition to describe new problems, they have also identified in Irish-American political methods a time-worn means of self-promotion. As a rule of thumb, the more Irish a multi-generation Irish-American politician sounds, the more scepticism he or she warrants.
The Americas.
The Economist, March 16th to March 22nd, 2019. In the Americas section. Brazil, the digital bully pulpit. Venezuela, lights out, but not curtains. Bayo, the reluctant liberal. And more.
The Americas.
Brazil. The digital bully pulpit. Jair Bolsonaro is a master of social media. But to what end?
Politicians start working only when carnival ends, Brazilians joke. This year, explosive tweets from the president, Jair Bolsonaro, delayed the serious business of reforming pensions and cleaning up crime and corruption. On March 5th, the president posted a video of one carnival reveller urinating on another in an act of performance art. "This is what many carnival street parties have become," he lamented. Some Brazilians cringed, but the tweet got 87,000 likes. Then, on March 10th, Mr. Bolsonaro excoriated a journalist from Estado de São Paulo, who is investigating his son, Flavio, a senator from Rio de Janeiro. Estadão mentiu, or Estado lied, became the top trending topic on Twitter in Brazil. The Bar Association criticised the president, but he has not taken down either tweet. Mr. Bolsonaro relies on social media even more than does Donald Trump, some of whose views of the world he shares. They are due to meet in Washington on March 19th. Unlike the American president, he does not hold raucous rallies. In contrast to Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, a left-wing former Brazilian president who is now serving a prison sentence for corruption, he does not relish physical contact with his supporters. He largely avoids appearances on the main television stations. Instead, Mr. Bolsonaro reaches most Brazilians in miniature, via their smartphones. His success may owe something to Brazilians' sizzling passion for social media. More Brazilians were on Orkut, a social network owned by Google, than citizens of any other country. As late as 2011, Orkut had 33 million Brazilian users. After the network's demise in 2014, Brazilians became the third largest nationality on Facebook, after Indians and Americans. Social media were Mr. Bolsonaro's only outlets when he launched his long-shot presidential campaign from the backbenches of Brazil's Congress. His tiny electoral coalition gave him little entitlement to free television and radio time. Angered by violence, scandals, and a deep recession, voters were ready for Mr. Bolsonaro's chest-thumping messages on crime, corruption, and family values. His early supporters distrust mainstream media, says Esther Solano of the Federal University of São Paulo, who has interviewed dozens of them. They assume that social media is more sincere because it's filled with friends and family. As president, Mr. Bolsonaro still posts often to his 10.7 million Facebook followers and the 3.7 million people who follow him on Twitter. Another of his sons, Carlos, a city councillor in Rio de Janeiro, is thought to manage the accounts and write many of his epigrams. On March 7th, the president gave a 20-minute talk on Facebook Live, the first of what he said would be a weekly series. The question is whether he can or will use such events to promote his government's most important programs. Unlike Mr. Trump, he makes no pretense of being an expert in most policy areas. He has outsourced pension reform, which is vital to stabilising the government's finances, to Paulo Guedes, the Liberal Economy Minister, and law enforcement to Sergio Moro, the Justice Minister. Mr. Bolsonaro uses social media to gratify his supporters more than to enlighten them. An analysis by Estado of his first 515 tweets as president, sent between January 1st and March 5th, found that 95 of them congratulated friends and allies, 51 were ideological, 31 criticised the press, 30 rebutted criticism, and just 5 mentioned pension reform. When he does broach reforms, his supporters push back. If I'd known he would send Paolo Guedes's rigid proposal, or Trojan horse, to Congress, I never would have voted for him, one woman wrote on Facebook. But Mr. Bolsonaro will have to risk that sort of backlash. Unlike past presidents, he does not have a big coalition held together by patronage and pork barrel spending. Though the government did recently offer 1 billion reais, or $260 million, for congressmen's pet projects. To advance his agenda, he needs to rally ordinary citizens more than his predecessors did. Hamilton Mourão, the vice president, says Mr. Bolsonaro should use social networks in language that people understand to convince them that the current pension system has been drained and the country will be ungovernable if we continue like this. Mr. Bolsonaro may be heeding him. In his first Facebook fireside chat, he spent 90 seconds talking up Nova Previdência, or new pensions, before returning to more congenial subjects. He lambasted the government for distributing pamphlets on sexual health to adolescents and promised to phase out speed cameras. Perhaps that is the way to sell pension reform. Brazilians must hope so.
The Americas.
Venezuela. Lights out, but not curtains. Will a catastrophic blackout dislodge the regime?
The scene by the polluted Guaire River that flows through central Caracas was dystopian. Residents from the nearby San Agustin slum had heard that a drainage pipe was leaking into the stream. They scrambled down its concrete banks with plastic containers to catch the water before it mixed with the sewage. On March 11th, Caracas's 2 million people had been without water for 4 days. That was an effect of the longest power cut ever to hit Venezuela, which affected all 23 states. At least 40 people died, many in the decrepit hospitals. They included several premature babies, whom nurses had tried to save by hand-pumping ventilators for hours on end. Power eventually returned to Caracas, but as The Economist went to press, the blackout continued in parts of the country. Nicolas Maduro, Venezuela's dictator, blamed it on sabotage by imperialists seeking to topple his government. In a televised address on March 12, he claimed that the demonic government of the United States had used electromagnetic waves from mobile devices to disable the power system. The chief prosecutor has called for the Supreme Court to investigate whether Juan Guaido, recognized by most Western and Latin American democracies as Venezuela's interim president, had a hand in sabotaging the power grid. The United States is leading an international campaign to remove Mr. Maduro, who has demolished democracy and wrecked the economy. It wants Mr. Guaido to succeed him. Mr. Maduro's re-election last year was rigged. The Constitution says that in the absence of a legitimate president, the job goes to the leader of the National Assembly, i.e. Mr. Guaido, pending an election. But there is no evidence that the United States turned out Venezuela's lights. Incompetence and corruption probably caused the blackout. It is thought to have started with a bushfire close to a transmission line from the Guri hydroelectric plant, which supplies 80% of Venezuela's electricity. That shut down the line, overloading the other two that deliver power from the plant, causing it to crash too. The complex process of restarting the system was botched, probably by inexperienced workers. Almost half the skilled employees of the state-run electricity monopoly Corpelec, whose salaries are worth just a few dollars a month, have emigrated, says Ali Briceño, executive secretary of Venezuela's Electrical Industry Union. Brilliant Venezuelan hackers and the armed forces repelled the supposed saboteurs, Mr. Maduro said. He promised that running water and power would soon return, but advised people nonetheless to buy torches and water tanks. That is good advice. Venezuela's economy, which has shrunk by 50% since Mr. Maduro succeeded Chavez in 2013, will now shrink faster. The United States, which had been the main cash buyer of oil, Venezuela's biggest export, imposed sanctions on PDVSA, the state oil company, in January. Very significant measures are planned for financial institutions that support the regime, says Elliot Abrams, the United States Special Envoy for Venezuela. The government of India, an alternative customer for Venezuela's oil, has, under American pressure, said it will ask importers to buy less. The power cut deepens these woes. It shut down the main port for oil tankers, bringing exports to a halt. Mr. Guaido and his American backers hope that economic chaos will force a change of regime. But the army continues to support Mr. Maduro, as do Russia and China. The government has replaced some of its lost oil income with sales of gold, some of it fresh mined. Few people turned out for a protest called by Mr. Guaido on March 12th. Despair is sapping the will to resist. As she waded through the Guaire River in search of clean water, Gladys Cisneros said she feels like a victim of a political game she does not understand. They are not harming Maduro, she lamented. They are not harming Guaido. But they are hurting me.
The Americas.
Colombia. Jeopardy. The president aims a blow at the peace accord with the FARC.
Iván Duque won Colombia's presidency last year on a promise to modify a peace deal between the government and the FARC guerrilla group, which ended their 52-year war in 2016. On March 10th this year, Mr. Duque kept that promise. In a televised speech, he stated six objections to a law governing the operation of a tribunal known as the HEP, that investigates and judges members of the FARC and the armed forces for war crimes and crimes against humanity. Although Congress passed the law in 2017 and the Constitutional Court endorsed it, Mr. Duque is sending it back to the legislature. We want a peace that genuinely guarantees truth, justice, reparation and non-repetition, he said. But his decision is a blow to the peace process. This is the first time a Colombian president has reopened a legal question that had been settled by the Constitutional Court. It is not clear that Congress has the power to change such a law for the reasons Mr. Duque put forward, or that it will do so. During his 7 months in office, Mr. Duque has tried to strike a balance between the hard line of his mentor, Álvaro Uribe, a former president who opposes the peace accord, and Colombians who want to preserve it. Now he seems to have backed Mr. Uribe's policy. The president wants former FARC members from lower ranks to go on trial and to ensure that the FARC compensate victims with their own assets. This may be smart politics. The HEP, which can issue lenient sentences to ex-fighters who confess to their crimes, is unpopular. It became more so on March 1st, when the Attorney General's office arrested a HEP prosecutor for allegedly taking a $500,000 bribe to protect a former FARC commander from extradition to the United States. Bashing the tribunal is a way for Mr. Duque to boost his own popularity, which plunged last year after he proposed an increase in value-added tax, though it has since recovered. The success of his gambit now depends on Congress and the Constitutional Court. Congress could override Mr. Duque's objections, forcing him to sign the law. That would be a humiliation. Even if Congress passes a modified law, the Constitutional Court is likely to strike it down. That would be a better result for Mr. Duque. The court would take up to a year to rule. In the meantime, the HEP will continue to function, but clumsily. Without the guidelines set out in the law, which give priority to trials of the most important FARC leaders or army officers, it will be up to six of the tribunal's judges to decide which defendants to try first. The danger is that the tribunal will start more trials than it can complete within its 10-year mandate. An overburdened HEP might end up convicting and punishing no one. Former FARC members had begun to disclose their crimes, such as kidnapping, in the tribunal. They may now fall silent, says Mariana Kasig of the Institute for Integrated Transitions, an NGO that helps resolve conflicts. The disruption of the HEP could have worse consequences. Around 2,000 former FARC fighters have kept their guns and continue to sell drugs and kill people in parts of Colombia. Now more ex-guerrillas may take up arms.
The Americas.
Bayo. The reluctant liberal. A new sort of leftism is emerging in Mexico.
The left has rarely been stronger in Mexico. Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the new president, won last year's election by a record margin and has sky-high approval ratings. For the first time, leftist lawmakers have a majority in both houses of Congress. Parties scorned by Mr. López Obrador as neoliberal, which misgoverned Mexico before he took power, are demoralized. But there are snags. Not all leftists in Congress belong to his Movement for National Regeneration, or Morena. Not all members of Morena and its allies are on the left, and those who are do not agree on what that means. Mr. López Obrador's priority is to strengthen the state as a weapon against what he calls economic injustice. Some of his allies are more interested in expanding social liberties or protecting the environment. The outcome of this tussle will help determine the legacy of Mr. López Obrador's government and the sort of country that Mexico will become. A row over abortion, flawlessly timed to spoil International Women's Day on March 8th, illustrates the tension. A pro-life Morena senator was apoplectic to find a green scarf, a pro-choice symbol imported from Argentina, placed on her chair. She used the occasion to denounce abortion as murder, which drew rebukes from other Morena lawmakers. Mr. López Obrador, who is often called AMLO, tried to quell the controversy. "We must not open these debates," he said. "Congress should focus instead on cleaning up government corruption. Morena has put off congressional debate about abortion, which is illegal in most cases in most Mexican states, until September." Unlike leftists in many other countries, AMLO has never been particularly green or socially liberal. He prefers the dirty oil extracted by state-owned Pemex to clean renewable energy. To the extent he thinks about social issues at all, his views are those of a moral conservative, says Clara Husidman, an economist who has known him since the 1980s. "Latin America's left does not care much about expanding social rights," notes Lorenzo Meyer, a historian whose son, Roman, is Secretary of Rural and Urban Development in AMLO's cabinet. Cuba's communists sent gay people to labor camps in the 1960s. Among the governments that took power in the region's pink tide in the 2000s and early 2010s, only Uruguay's legalized abortion. Nayib Bukele, El Salvador's left-leaning, hip-hop-loving president-elect, has no plans to unban same-sex marriage. Though conservative on social matters, AMLO is not doctrinaire. He may thus find himself shepherding in more social and environmental change than he had planned. He has given social liberals top jobs. Olga Sanchez Cordero, the Interior Minister, and Marcelo Ebrard, the Foreign Minister, are European-style social democrats who grew up in middle-class families in Mexico City. Claudia Sheinbaum, the capital's new mayor, was an author for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change when it won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. Liberals lead both chambers of Congress. Mr. Ebrard, who followed AMLO as Mexico City's mayor in 2006, legalized same-sex marriage and abortion in the city. Last week, Ms. Sanchez Cordero floated the idea of a national law that would allow abortion on demand in the first 12 weeks of pregnancy. She has introduced a bill to legalize cannabis for recreational use, which could make Mexico the third country after Uruguay and Canada to take that step. In December, AMLO mooted the possibility of legalizing assisted dying. Mexico was becoming more liberal before he took office. 14 of Mexico's 31 states already have laws that allow same-sex marriage. As Mexico grows richer, the hold of the Catholic Church is likely to weaken, as it has done in Chile. Travel and technology are making younger Mexicans more cosmopolitan. AMLO may give such trends an extra push by choosing a moderate to be his political heir. He is due to leave office in 2024. That would follow the example of Lázaro Cárdenas, a leftist president of the 1930s. Mr. Ebrard and Ms. Sheinbaum are his most likely successors. But Mexico is still conservative. AMLO's election victory, after a campaign during which social issues were barely mentioned, did not change that. This month, the state of Nuevo León changed its constitution to say that life begins at conception. AMLO remains fixated on making poor Mexicans richer. The irony is that if he succeeds, he may also make many of them more liberal.
Asia.
The Economist, March 16th to March 22nd, 2019. In the Asia section, Thailand's rigged election, all for show. Banyan on the art of the impossible. Renaming the Philippines, back to basics, and more.
Asia.
Thailand's rigged election, all for show. The generals plan to remain in charge, whatever the voters say.
We will take good care of the price of rice in the market, declares Uttama Savanayana, the leader of the Palang Pracharat Party, to a sweating crowd of farmers in Thailand's northeast. The party, which supports the ruling military regime and is staffed by several of its former ministers, such as Mr. Uttama, was founded last year. It will carry the flag for the junta in a national election on March 24th. The generals, having supposedly put an end to the instability they cited to justify taking power 5 years ago, are now purporting to return power to the people. It is ironic that the chief failing of the government the generals ousted, according to the courts, was to cause losses to the state by intervening in the rice market. But this seems lost on Mr. Uttama. Then again, his party also does not seem to see the irony in naming as its candidate to lead a restored democratic government the man who overthrew the previous one, Prayut Chan-o-cha, the junta's leader and the current prime minister. The election is the first since 2011. A partially boycotted one in 2014 was invalidated, and many Thais are delighted at the chance to vote. Roughly 7 million are eligible to do so for the first time. Turnout may be as high as 80%. Dozens of parties and thousands of candidates are running. They fall roughly into three camps: those who support the generals and their attempts to retain power, those who abhor the regime and are pushing for greater democratic freedom, and fence sitters. The three camps reflect deeper divisions. For the past 13 years, royalist elites and military types known as yellow shirts have feuded with those keener on electoral democracy known as red shirts. Thaksin Shinawat, a populist former prime minister who has lived in exile since being ousted in a coup in 2006, is the figurehead for the Reds. Parties linked to him have won every election since 2001, so the junta has designed an electoral system to thwart him. The new parliament will consist of a 250-seat Senate and a 500-seat House of Representatives. The entire Senate will be appointed by the junta. The Prime Minister, who does not need to be a member of Parliament, will be selected by a joint sitting of the two houses. That means that Mr. Prayut, with the Senate in the bag, would require just 126 supporters in the House to keep his job. To foil Per Thai, Mr. Thaksin's main political party, and help the likes of Palang Pracharat, the government has introduced a contorted, partly proportional voting system that favours smaller parties. Only 350 seats will go to the winner of the vote in each constituency. Votes for losing candidates will be used to allocate the 150 party list seats. According to Prajak Kongirati of Thammasat University in Bangkok, if Per Thai wins the same share of the constituency vote as it did in 2011, it will receive 41 fewer seats. The generals have other tools at their disposal too. Section 44 of the interim constitution that they promulgated shortly after seizing power allows them to do almost anything in the name of protecting the monarchy, national security, public order, and other worthy causes. It will cease to apply only once a new cabinet is installed after the election. A harsh cyber security law allows the government to monitor online traffic in the event of an emergency. A proliferation of obscure rules surrounds campaigning. Doling out any sort of gift to supporters is prohibited. So is mentioning the monarchy. The single placard allowed to be posted at each party office cannot exceed 4 metres by 7.5 metres. On social media, posts with anything other than candidates' names, pictures and biographies, and the party's name, logo, policies and slogans are banned. Politicians fear that minor violations of these rules may result in disqualification or other punishments from the Election Commission, before or after the election. It can dole out yellow cards, which require a new ballot in the constituency concerned, or red cards, which require a rerun without the offending candidate. The Constitutional Court, at the Commission's recommendation, has already dissolved another party favourable to Mr. Thaksin, Thai Raksa Chart, and banned its leaders from politics for a decade. The court said that by naming a princess as its preferred candidate for Prime Minister, the party had shown itself to be hostile to democracy, even though the move was not against the law and Thailand has had prime ministers of royal descent in the past. This is the third time a party linked to Mr. Thaksin has been banned. Thai Raksa Chart was fielding candidates in 100 constituencies. They have all been struck from the ballot. They are not the only opponents of the junta to face legal troubles. On March 21st, the Attorney General will announce whether he intends to charge two candidates for Per Thai and a senior member of Thai Raksa Chart with sedition for attempting to hold a press conference last year to discuss the regime's failings. Three members of Future Forward, a popular new party, including its leader Thanatorn Junrung Ruket, were charged with computer crimes last month. They apparently uploaded false information during Facebook Live sessions last year when they stated, truthfully, that the junta had been poaching MPs from other parties. The junta's assiduous efforts to manipulate the election have led it to neglect much else. For a regime with almost unlimited powers, it has got little done. Although it has promised lots of new infrastructure, not much has materialised. Meanwhile, it has neglected even bigger drags on the economy, such as the sorry state of the education system. Growth has been relatively stable since the last coup, but lower than in Mr. Thaksin's heyday. The poorest two-fifths of Thais have seen their incomes drop. Farmers reminisce about the far higher prices of commodities such as rubber and rice under Mr. Thaksin's leadership. The most recent data from the National Statistics Service show farm debt rising from 2.4 trillion baht, that's $67 billion in 2016, to 2.8 trillion baht the following year. Palang Pracharat loudly touts the welfare cards the junta has introduced, which provide a small monthly stipend to be spent on subsidised goods at designated shops. More than 14 million of them have been handed out to the poorest Thais. At a rally for the party in a huge auditorium at Ubon Ratchathani University, Tongpan Puangpua says she is there because of her card, even if it is a bit complicated to use. She used to support Per Thai. The party also promises more help for expectant mothers and those with young children, as well as 3 years of relief from debt repayments, subsidies for rice farmers, and other goodies. Mainly, however, it pledges stability and continuity. When they are not simply bashing the junta, Per Thai's candidates try to lure voters with similar handouts. They say they will improve the welfare card scheme and promise debt relief and subsidies for farmers, as well as a big cut in military spending. Sudarat Gayurapan, a former health minister under Mr. Thaksin, is its most prominent leader. She is the main attraction at the party's bustling rallies in Isan, the northeastern region that elects more MPs than any other part of the country. But the gatherings are not as crammed as they were 8 years ago, says Titipol Pakdiwanich, a local academic. One party insider worries that its standard bearers are not popular enough to secure yet another election victory. Analysts agree, assuming that Per Thai will remain the biggest party but not win enough seats to overturn Mr. Prayut's built-in advantage. Even with the support of other parties at odds with the junta, such as Future Forward, Per Thai will struggle to muster the 376 seats to form a government. However, analysts also project that Palang Pracharat will fall short of the 126 seats Mr. Prayut needs to remain Prime Minister. That means he will have to win over some smaller parties or strike a deal with the Democrats, who may emerge as the second biggest party. They are yellow shirts, broadly speaking, but the party's leader, Apisit Wechichawa, says Mr. Prayut should not stay on as Prime Minister. Given that the Election Commission has 60 days before it must announce the official results, there will be plenty of time for the generals to secure the outcome they want. King Wachiralongkorn's glitzy coronation ceremony will probably occur in the midst of it all, distracting the public from unseemly goings-on. But if Mr. Prayut has to knock heads to keep his job, his new government is likely to be even less effective than the current one. He may not need a majority among elected MPs to become Prime Minister, but he will need one to pass legislation. "I'm only half confident in this election," confides a farmer watching Mr. Uttama speak in Isan. "She is being extremely generous."
Asia.
Banyan. The art of the impossible. Narendra Modi is having a good war.
The starter's gun has been fired on the biggest democratic exercise on earth, an Indian general election. The Election Commission has set out a schedule for the country's 900 million-odd eligible voters to select a new parliament in seven stages, with results due on May 23rd. The process, despite electronic voting and an increase in polling stations to 1 million, is lumbering. The scale is intimidating. Some 84 million Indians, a whole Germany, have become eligible to vote since the previous poll in 2014. To young Indians, economic opportunity counts above all. 5 years ago, Narendra Modi clothed a reputation as a Hindu firebrand in an inclusive message about jobs and progress. Sabka Saath, Sabka Vikas, or altogether development for all. His Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, swept to power. Yet Mr. Modi's record is patchy. Growth of 6.6% might sound good, but it has not generated enough work. His promise of 10 million new jobs a year has proven hollow. Unemployment is close to half-century highs. In the countryside, the strains are severe. 5 years ago, India's 230 million farmers opted for Mr. Modi in droves. Yet in office, he eased imports of food and curbed exports to bring prices down. That was good for urban consumers, but hurt farmers, many of whom protested. Then, just over 2 years ago, the government voided over four-fifths of banknotes in circulation. The move was supposedly to curb corruption and tax evasion. In practice, it hit lowly trades, from farmers to barbers, whose receipts are in cash. Rural Muslims and lower caste Hindus have faced growing violence from vigilantes out to lynch people suspected of slaughtering cows, which are sacred to Hindus, or just acting above their station. Mr. Modi, to whom inclusiveness does not come naturally, has often met such outrages with silence. Congress, the once lame opposition, has found new pep. Late last year, it won three state elections in the BJP's Hindi-speaking heartland. Even its 48-year-old president, Rahul Gandhi, a political dynast with the perennial air of a management trainee, has shown leadership, landing punches on Mr. Modi over the economy and murky procurement deals. But what a difference a few airstrikes make. Mr. Modi has changed the dynamics of the race with his response to the deaths of 40 paramilitary police in a suicide bombing in Kashmir on February 14th that was claimed by Jaish-e-Mohammed, or JEM, a terrorist group based in Pakistan. The chattering classes of New Delhi, who despise Mr. Modi and his coterie as cynical rabble-rousers, hold that view reluctantly. They level justified criticism at the Prime Minister for dangerously escalating matters with a rival nuclear power by sending warplanes to bomb undisputed Pakistani territory, a first for either side since 1971. They level scorn at government claims to have killed hundreds of JEM terrorists when the presumed target, an empty madrasa, may, intentionally or otherwise, not even have been hit. They say Mr. Modi's adventurism stands in contrast to the statesmanship of his Pakistani counterpart, Imran Khan, who swiftly handed back a downed Indian pilot, Abhinandan Vardhman. And, again justifiably, they worry that crucial national security decisions are being made by only a tiny band around Mr. Modi. Even the defence minister is said to be out of the loop. To many voters, though, none of this matters. Mr. Vardhman, whose bewhiskered face has popped up on billboards, is a national hero. At weekends, enthusiastic crowds flock to the new war memorial behind India Gate. Jingoism abounds. The national cricket team has taken to playing in army camouflage caps. Cabin attendants with Air India, the state airline, are required to proclaim Jai Hind, victory for India, after every announcement. They must do this after a slight pause and with much fervour. Mr. Modi is in his element again. Settling scores, he says proudly, is my habit. That is a challenge not just to jihadists whom the Prime Minister has promised to go below the seven seas to find. It is a dog whistle to bigots looking for other supposed traitors, among them the harmless Kashmiri fruit sellers recently beaten up in Lucknow. Mr. Modi knows that even Indians at the bottom of the pile, exposed to social media and tub-thumping television channels, are patriots. Many are surely warming to him. Namumkim ab mumkim hay, the impossible is now possible, is the new government slogan. Mr. Modi, for one, is not writing himself off.
Asia.
Afghanistan's Syrian problem. Demob unhappy. Afghans are worried about the return of Shias who fought in Syria's civil war.
Alireza Kanbari has still not told his parents the truth about what he did when he left Afghanistan for Iran. The 23-year-old is happy for his father to believe he worked as a labourer. In fact, he fought with an Afghan militia recruited by Iran to help prop up the government in Syria's civil war. With the war now dying down, Afghan fighters are starting to come home, just as the West agonises about the return of radicalised emigres. Many in Afghanistan worry about what the former fighters will do and where their loyalties lie. At its height, the Fatemiyun, as the Afghan militia was known, had as many as 20,000 fighters, largely from the Hazara ethnic minority. Most Hazaras are Shia Muslims, as are the ruling elite in both Iran and Syria. Long downtrodden, Hazaras were especially persecuted by the Sunni Muslims of the Taliban. More recently, the Afghan branch of Islamic State has launched terror attacks on Hazara targets. Mr. Kanbari, which is not his real name, was desperate to escape stifling poverty in the countryside near Herat, close to Afghanistan's border with Iran. So, like many of his peers, he crossed the frontier to find work. A Hazara friend of his in Iran disappeared, only to resurface 9 months later in a military hospital. His friend revealed he had been wounded in Syria with the Fatemiyun, which paid three times a labourer's wage. Moreover, Iran was handing out prized residency permits to those who fought, a powerful incentive given that around 250,000 Afghans who lack the right papers are deported from Iran each year. There were also historical reasons for the birth of the Fatemiyun. Many Afghans had fought for their neighbour during the Iran-Iraq War, and ties between those veterans and the Iranian security apparatus endured. The founder of the Fatemiyun, Alireza Tavassoli, was one such veteran. While most recruits joined the Fatemiyun for the money, they also received religious indoctrination, Mr. Kanbari and others say. Young recruits were told they would be defending Shia shrines against Islamic State. After scant training, they were sent into some of the war's worst fighting and suffered terrible casualties. Although most Fatemiyun veterans are thought to have remained in Iran, many have returned to Afghanistan. That is causing unease. During the most chaotic phase of Afghanistan's civil war in the 1990s, Iran backed militias as proxies, just as Pakistan backed the Taliban. The Fatemiyun may play such a role in the future, Afghan intelligence officials fear. It is a concern that when the national interests of the country that trained them are in danger, these people will go back and even act against our national interests, says Syed Azim Kabazani, an MP from Herat. Fatemiyun veterans say they feel they are under scrutiny by the authorities. They are reluctant to talk to journalists. Yet Iran would struggle to mobilise the Fatemiyun inside Afghanistan, says Syed Reza Kazemi, an academic. There would also be great resistance among Afghan Shias to any sort of mobilisation against the Afghan state. Hazaras have benefited from the current political order and have no desire to turn against it. A more likely prospect, says Ahmad Shuja, who has interviewed dozens of Hazara leaders and veterans for a report for the United States Institute of Peace, is that if security in the Hazara areas worsens and residents feel abandoned, veterans will form self-defense forces. When Taliban fighters overran previously safe Hazara areas in central Afghanistan last year, Fatemiyun veterans tried to hold them off, but were not well organised, intelligence officials say. Mr. Kanbari carries many scars from his years at the front. His mental health has suffered and he is prone to seizures, but he is also unemployed and short of money. With Iran having declared victory in Syria, the future of the Fatemiyun is uncertain. In January, America blacklisted it for its ties to Iran's Revolutionary Guards. But Mr. Kanbari wonders if his best hope is to return to Iran and start lying to his parents again.
Asia.
Japan. The unkindest cut. The Supreme Court agrees that transgender people should be sterilised.
Should transgender people be sterilised before they are recognised? Earlier this year, Japan's Supreme Court decided that the answer is yes. Takakito Usui, a transgender man, i.e. someone who was born female but identifies as male, had sued over a requirement that, to be officially designated a man, he has to have his ovaries and uterus removed, as well as have surgery to make his genitals look male, be over 20, single, have no minor children, and have been diagnosed as suffering from gender identity disorder. He argued that all this violated his right to self-determination and was therefore unconstitutional. The court disagreed. Human rights groups say demanding irreversible surgery is outrageous. Although several Asian countries, including South Korea, have similar laws, Western countries that once also used to require sterilisation, such as Norway, France and Sweden, no longer do. In 2017, the European Court of Human Rights called for the change in all 47 countries under its jurisdiction. Sweden has started to compensate transgender people who underwent mandatory sterilisation. Critics of Japan's laws also reject the notion that transgender people are suffering from a psychological disorder. The movement here has not been viewed as about rights, but more about helping sick people overcome their illness, says Junko Mitsuhashi, a professor and campaigner who studies the history of transgender issues. She is also a transgender woman who has not gained legal recognition for her gender, having been unwilling to undergo massively invasive surgery. Japanese courts often seem more concerned with maintaining social harmony than defending individual rights. In its ruling, the court said that the law was intended to avoid confusion and abrupt change to society. Yukari Ishii, a researcher at Toyo University in Tokyo, says that whereas in America and Europe long campaigns for gay rights paved the way for transgender people to call for more equitable treatment, Japan is further behind. Japanese society is patriarchal and retains strong gender stereotypes, she says. Change is coming, however. The court in Mr. Usui's case did acknowledge that the law may need to evolve as society does. Polls suggest that Japan is becoming more liberal on many social issues. Over 70% of respondents to a survey in January said they were in favour of stronger legal protections for gay or transgender people. Almost no Japanese ground their objections to such rights in religion, as people often do in other countries. In recent years, a handful of Japanese towns and cities have introduced partnership certificates for same-sex couples. Some have gender-neutral bathrooms. A small number of firms are trying to be more welcoming to transgender people, as well as offering benefits to same-sex partners. Ms. Mitsuhashi says she has had no problems at her university. In contrast, when she first came out as transgender, one of her employers at the time fired her. Nonetheless, Japan needs to be much readier to accept diversity in general, says Ms. Ishii. The country can be Don-kan, thick-headed, about where the world is going, says Ms. Mitsuhashi.
Asia.
Renaming the Philippines. Back to basics. The president has another big idea.
Rodrigo Duterte, the perpetually disgruntled president of the Philippines, is unhappy about the name of his country. "I want to change it someday," he remarked earlier this month in one of his customary rambling speeches. "No particular name yet, but sure, I would like to change the name of the Philippines because the Philippines is named after King Philip." The Philip in question was a 16th century king of Spain. A Portuguese explorer in the pay of the Spanish crown, Ferdinand Magellan, was the first European to visit the archipelago, which he claimed for Spain. He was then killed by locals. Mr. Duterte says he would prefer a name inspired by the indigenous Malay culture. It was the second time in 3 weeks that Mr. Duterte had called for a new name, making it sound like an official government policy. But his spokesman, Salvador Panelo, is woolly about that. He is expressing an idea again, as usual. If it is policy, it will require an amendment to the constitution, which would have to be approved by plebiscite. That seems unlikely. If the reminder of colonialism makes ordinary Filipinos bridle, they do so less openly than their president. And the first time Mr. Duterte aired the idea of a name change in February, he diminished the chances of it ever becoming reality by suggesting a new name associated with Ferdinand Marcos, a former dictator, Maharlika. Mr. Duterte explained, "Marcos, he is really right. He wanted to change the name to Maharlika, the Republic of Maharlika, because Maharlika is a Malay word." Mr. Marcos thought the word meant nobility and said it had been the name of a guerrilla group he claimed to have led to resist Japanese occupation during the Second World War. Most historians, however, believe that Mr. Marcos invented the guerrilla group or wildly exaggerated its exploits in order to cast himself as a war hero. Many academics also dispute the assertion that Maharlika means nobility, saying it refers to a lower class in the ancient hierarchy. Moreover, the word does not seem to be Malay at all, but rather derived from Sanskrit. The consensus seems to be that it means man of ability, although a persistent minority translate it as big phallus. In 2016, an online petition urged Mr. Duterte to rename the Philippines the Republic of Maharlika. Of the country's 105 million citizens, just 7 signed up.
Asia.
Politics in Indonesia. Outer Island Views. In remote parts of the archipelago, voters feel let down.
The main market in Ambon, the capital of the Indonesian province of Maluku, is a riotous affair. Stalls sprawl from the pavement into the road. Shouting over the screech and rattle of traffic, vendors and customers haggle over bags of spices and fresh-cut bunches of bananas. The smell of durians and barbecued fish hangs in the air. Amid the hubbub, a group of vendors finds time to talk politics. They hold a dim view of their leaders in Jakarta, Indonesia's distant capital, insisting that their lives are never improved by new policies. "The central government does not really think about us," says one. "It just does whatever people in the West think." By the West, she means the islands of Java and Sumatra, which together are home to more than 3/4 of Indonesians. The rest are spread across a further 13,000 or so islands. On April 17th, 190 million voters across the archipelago will head to the polls to pick a president, as well as national and regional legislatures. Because national politicians naturally lavish attention on the most populous places, people in the far-flung corners of the country often feel neglected. Maluku is a good example. It is sparsely populated, with less than 2 million of the country's 265 million people. It is also remote, some 2,400 kilometres from Jakarta. Small wonder national politicians rarely visit. That peeves Malukans, giving them the sense that their problems are not understood by those in power in Jakarta. Olivia Latukonsina, a candidate for the local parliament, points out that Maluku consists of more than 1,400 islands. That makes building infrastructure and delivering public services much more expensive than on Java. But this cost is not reflected in the central government's transfers to the regions. Poor public services, partly due to meagre funding, amplify resentment. In remote bits of Maluku, schools lack textbooks and classrooms. Teachers are often anyone from the village with a high school diploma. On some islands, locals have to get in a boat even to collect fresh water. Malukans are aghast when they see photos of Jakarta's highways and high-rises. We are being left behind, laments Iqbal Kumkello, a student. Almost a fifth of Moluccans live below the poverty line of $28 a month, twice the national average. GDP per person in the province is about $1,700, on a par with Congo. In Jakarta, it is 10 times higher, similar to Poland's. Last year, three villagers in a remote part of the province died of starvation before the government could send aid after rodents ate their crops. In theory, a strong local government should help counter the sense of disenfranchisement. In 1999, Indonesia started a process of decentralisation, partly to sap support for the country's various separatist movements, including a largely dormant one in Maluku. Provincial and local governments have accrued ever more powers. They now account for half of all government spending. But many in Maluku have lost trust in local politicians, citing broken promises. Ido, a fisherman, complains that a lending scheme announced by the local mayor never got off the ground. Rolly, another fisherman, says local officials only distribute handouts from the central government to their friends and relatives. One well-connected farmer was given free fishing equipment which lies unused in his field. Nonetheless, Moluccans seem determined to vote. Students, businessmen, fishermen and street vendors all proudly say that it is their duty to participate, no matter how disillusioned they feel. And the province is refreshingly free of identity politics. Most Indonesians are Muslims. Elections often become contests of piety rather than policy. Smear campaigns have accused Joko Widodo, the president, who is running for re-election, of being a closet Christian. Maluku, where two-fifths of people are Christian, suffered a paroxysm of religious violence from 1999 to 2002. More than 5,000 people died. Those horrors have made Moluccans particularly wary of attempts to capitalise on divisions between Christians and Muslims. Two of the local candidates for PAN, an Islamic party, are Protestant. A Muslim student group recently helped paint a new church near their university. "We are united, just like brothers and sisters," says Max Halusi, a local priest. It is a unity forged in adversity.
China.
The Economist, March 16th to March 22nd, 2019. In the China section, health products, spin doctors, comedy, a blind eye to turn, and Chagwan, let policy wants proliferate.
China.
Health products. Spin doctors. A scandal surrounds a big seller of traditional medicine. How much is local government to blame?
The fake advertisement was uncommonly cruel. Joe Early, a farmer from Inner Mongolia, first noticed it gaining popularity online when his four-year-old daughter, sick with cancer, was in intensive care. His girl was smiling in a photograph being circulated by Quan Jian, a big health products company. The ad claimed she had fully returned to health after taking the firm's miraculous herbal remedies. "In fact," says Mr. Zhou, "bosses at Quan Jian had told him to take his daughter off her chemotherapy treatment at a state-run children's hospital in Beijing. They had offered what they assured him was a potent new cure, a drink made of jujube powder and Gromwell root oil. He had spent 5,000 yuan, that's $800, on it. But his daughter's cancer had spread. In 2015, after the ad appeared, Mr. Zhou filed a lawsuit alleging that the company had duped him, but the court dismissed his case for lack of evidence. Little Zhou Yang died a few months later." Her story might have ended there had it not been taken up by a popular online myth-busting forum, Ding Shang Doctor. In late December, In an article that went viral, the website took aim at Quanjian, which it said had been taking in billions of yuan from annual sales. It had investments in football and equestrian clubs, cosmetics, banking, insurance and hotels. The article said the firm had earned huge profits by swindling patients. It accused Quanjian's founder and boss, Xu Yuhui, of running the company like an illegal pyramid scheme. Guanjian's salespeople, Ding Shang Doctor said, made money mainly by corralling new ones to join, earning commission on their sales too. Amid an online outcry, the government reacted swiftly. Mr. Xu's name disappeared from a list of advisers to the legislature in Tianjin, a northern port city where his company is based. On January 7th, state media reported that Mr. Xu and 17 others had been arrested. Market regulators launched a 100-day inspection of the health product business. By March 1st, more than 4,800 cases had been lodged against firms involved in it, the regulators said. On a recent visit to the site of Quanjian's headquarters in a semi-rural suburb of Tianjin, a lone employee said the firm was closed. Nearby noodle restaurants that once fed its staff were shuttered. Ownership of the firm's crown jewel, Tianjin Quanjian FC, now Tianjin Tianhai, has been transferred to the local football association. The club is seeking a new investor. It has been a remarkable fall for one of Tianjin's health giants. A guard says the headquarters was once busy, like Tiananmen Square. Buses from out of town daily disgorged hundreds of Quanjian teachers, as the firm called its senior salespeople. Mr. Xu once boasted that his 10,000-bed cancer hospital was the largest in Asia. It is now shut. In the company's heyday, over 7,000 shops nationwide offered Quanjian's signature fire therapy. Patients are draped in alcohol-soaked towels and set alight. Among its popular products were negative ion sanitary pads that claimed to prevent menstrual cramping and cervical cancer. The brand's insoles, which purport to cure arthritis and heart disease, are still available online. A pair sells for 1,068 yuan. Tianjin has been known since imperial days for healthcare research and manufacturing. Tong Ren Tang, a 350-year-old herbal medicine business, is based in the nearby capital. It is the best-known maker of traditional Chinese medicine, a system of often unproven remedies that goes back 2,500 years. Zhu Yonghong, co-founder of Tasli, a big traditional medicine firm in Tianjin, says Quanjian and firms like it set up in Tianjin to profit from Tong Ren Tang's aura. According to Mr. Zhu, they blurred the line between regulated traditional medicine and outright quackery. Quanjian's founder, Mr. Xu, first came to the port to work for Tianxi, known abroad as Tian's, a large seller of health products. The company's name means heavenly lion. Two such beasts with gigantic wings flank the entrance to Tianxi's headquarters. The firm says it has more than 10,000 staff in 110 countries. It also owns hotels, a college, and a hot spring resort. Its chairman, Li Jinyuan, a former oilfield worker, is Tianjin's richest man. In 2015, he took 6,000 staff to France on a splashy holiday. Sustaining this are Tianxi's machines, offering diagnoses based on palm readings. They claim to detect ailments ranging from HIV to hepatitis, for which the firm offers pricey treatments. According to his biography, Mr. Xu later set up Quanjian with 600 secret traditional recipes. He is said to come from a family of herbal doctors. A board in the entrance to his shuttered hospital reads, "To say something is real that isn't is deception. To make something real that isn't is skill." A user on Weibo, a Twitter-like site, sums up the appeal. Quan Jian tells patients they will live when hospitals tell them they will die. To boost demand for its products, Quan Jian devised an alluring scheme. Buying 7 pairs of the magic insoles would earn a member the right to become a distributor. To innocent consumers, that seemed above board. Quan Jian has all the trappings of a legal direct sales firm, including licenses from the Ministry of Commerce. In February, the ministry said it had suspended the issuing of permits for direct selling. But Quan Jian's pyramid-type recruitment method is banned. Companies that use it are commonly described in China as business cults. That is because gangs often ensnare job seekers into joining. Ecstatic rallies keep alive participants' illusory dreams of enrichment. Local governments, eager to foster the growth of job-creating firms, have an incentive to turn a blind eye. Last year, Tianjin's said Quan Jian, as well as Tianxi, which is involved in direct selling but has not been publicly accused of wrongdoing, were brilliant national corporations that were socially responsible and innovative. Health product firms are among Tianjin's most valuable companies. Quan Jian paid 147 million yuan in local taxes in 2017. This causes some bosses in Tianjin's health industry to wonder whether the authorities' action against Mr. Xu may be about more than his company's products and sales techniques. Could he have offended a powerful politician? After all, many cases similar to that of Mr. Zhou's daughter have gone unheeded by the government. Since 2009, according to court papers, activities carried out in Tianxi's name have been linked to 155 deaths and 2,781 cases of illegal activity. The company blames these on criminals usurping its name. On February 18th, police in Tianjin rejected a case filed by Mr. Zhou in which he accused Quan Jian and its boss of using his daughter for false advertising. The outcome of another recent case is disheartening. In December 2017, Hong Mao Yao Ju, a popular traditional tonic from Inner Mongolia that has long billed itself as a cure-all for the elderly, was denounced online by a doctor as ineffective and harmful. Police jailed him for 3 months, despite public indignation, soon censored online. On his release, he apologised publicly for not thinking clearly. On China's social media, it did not go unnoticed that an evening news segment on the Quan Jian arrests was followed by an ad for the tonic.
China.
Comedy. A blind eye to turn. Despite the Communist Party's war on smut, performers keep delivering it.
Cut. That was dead awful. Deliver with more passion, roars He Xiaoying at a group of adolescent girls who had been rehearsing a comedy routine. Ms. He is the eponymous head of a boarding school in the northeastern city of Changchun in China's Rust Belt. Her mission is to train young people in the art of Aranjuan, or two-person turn, a traditional form of comic song and dance that often involves raunchy gags. The children also study subjects that are more academic, but these take a back seat. There are at least a dozen such schools in the three provinces of the northeast where Aranjuan originated. Ms. He's 80-odd students, most from poor backgrounds, dream of appearing on national television, or failing that, at a well-known theatre. In a region plagued by unemployment, some people see a promising future in comedy. Aranjuan requires arduous training. It involves duets, typically between a man and a woman, that are often delivered in 7 or 10 character rhyming lines. The dance is usually in folk style, as is the performer's dress, though modern touches are permissible. In the northeast, where Aranjuan has many fans, some proudly call it the world's hardest form of comedy. It is certainly among the most notorious in China for its bawdiness. A common routine is called the 18 touches. One variant of this involves a female performer cracking lewd jokes while stroking the genitals of her male counterpart with his trousers on. In 2004, Zhao Benshan, the godfather of Aranjuan and China's first billionaire comedian, said Aranjuan without smut was not Aranjuan at all. President Xi Jinping is no fan of lewd comedy. In 2014, in a speech on the role of the arts, Mr. Xi said some artists were spewing out cultural garbage. He demanded that creative work serve the Communist Party and not provoke the ecstasy of the senses. It may be no coincidence that Mr. Zhao has not appeared on national television's Chinese New Year gala since Mr. Xi assumed power in 2012. He had once been a regular, in cleaned-up form, on the hugely popular show. Last year, Mr. Zhao was booted out of the advisory body to China's parliament. His flamboyant lifestyle may also have contributed to his fall from grace. Mr. Zhao is now leading a campaign to bowdlerise Aranjuan. In his chain of theatres, he puts on only family fare. Dirty jokes and swearing are all but banned. Other venues have followed suit. Television stations only invite the cleanest Aranjuan performers. Ms. He, the head teacher, says she does not teach her students any dirty lines or gestures. A Changchun resident says this trend may explain why attendance at Aranjuan theatres is falling. But head to public parks in the northeast and you will find the art form refreshingly unchanged. Aranjuan entertainers often make extra money with impromptu open-air gigs. On a recent afternoon in Changchun's Labour Park, an animated crowd surrounds an Aranjuan duo. Egged on by the audience, the pair engage in profanity-laced banter and sway their hips suggestively. After the show, the crowd disperses, but quickly forms again around another act nearby. It involves a male performer reaching up his female partner's dress. The woman smiles at him seductively, then slaps his face. The park's security guards, whose job might be supposed to include putting a stop to such displays, appear happy to watch.
China.
Chagwan. Let policy wonks proliferate. Xi Jinping is encouraging a boom in independent Chinese think tanks. What does that mean?
Frustrated by the quality of the advice he was receiving, the first Sung Emperor of China had an idea. The 10th century ruler, it is said, promised that officials would not be executed for disagreeing with him. President Xi Jinping appears to be testing a less flamboyant remedy to a similar problem. To ensure a supply of diverse opinions, even as public debates face strict controls, Mr. Xi is encouraging a boom in think tanks with Chinese characteristics. State-funded think tanks, many of them serving individual ministries or Communist Party bodies, have long existed in China. But recent years have seen a flourishing of think tanks that eschew direct state sponsorship. Some are privately funded foundations or attached to universities. Others register as private consulting firms, bringing both flexibility and vulnerability. The boom throws up puzzles. In the West, measuring clout is easy. When a Democrat wins the White House, a flotilla of progressive wonks bobs across Washington from places like the Brookings Institution to join the government. When a Republican is elected, conservative wonks who share the winner's politics take their turn. Hard-edged partisan think tanks have hit the jackpot under President Donald Trump. In Europe, think tanks send staff into government as special advisers and work to shape public debate. Assessing influence is harder in China, where the revolving door is one way. Officials may retire into think tanks but seldom return to government, and the party in power never changes. In China, real influence is rarely wielded in public. Among researchers, the term neibu, or internal, is used a lot. Each day, favoured think tanks and universities send policy papers via neibu channels to Mr. Xi and other leaders. If he reads a paper, or a high honour, scrawls a note in its margins, aides send word to its authors, casting a roseate glow over all involved. Well-connected think tanks send staff to internal government and party meetings. Behind closed doors, their scholars weigh in on big, divisive questions. An example is the Belt and Road Initiative, a scheme to connect the world with railway lines, telecommunications networks, and other infrastructure. Some think tanks argue that China gains by funding and controlling the project. Others call it a financial and diplomatic burden that should be shared with other countries. During the trade war with America, scholars have been summoned to advise on the wording of Chinese government announcements. Smart think tanks prepare public and neibu versions of papers. They are also asked by officials to advance arguments that bigwigs prefer not to make aloud. Distrust any policy wonk who claims to speak for a grandee, though, says a prominent researcher, if he is really close to those VVVIPs, he cannot tell you. Chaguan asked the heads of some very different think tanks about another puzzle. That proximity to power is good for prestige but bad for credibility, especially in an autocracy. Diplomats and foreign analysts call the China Institutes of Contemporary International Relations, or CICIR, the country's shrewdest foreign policy think tank, despite, or perhaps because of, its links to the deep state. With over 200 scholars following both individual countries and broad questions of national security, CICIR's leafy campus resembles a small university. Paramilitary guards and massive gates hint at CICIR's unacknowledged affiliation with the Ministry of State Security, China's main intelligence service. CICIR's president, Yuan Peng, notes that Western think tanks use punchy phrases and attack politicians for past blunders. CICIR uses subtle language to describe present realities accurately and to offer constructive suggestions about the future, he says. Mr. Yuan accepts no lessons about objectivity from the West, calling American think tanks beholden to rich ideologues. Western think tanks are independent from government but not from interest groups. Wang Huiyao leads the Center for China and Globalization, a think tank that promotes free trade and greater opening to the world. Mr. Wang is proud that his independent think tank is funded by Chinese entrepreneurs and companies, not the state. But he is an outsider with neibu access, serving as an appointed advisor to the State Council or Cabinet and as vice chairman of a group that seeks to influence foreign-educated Chinese, the Western Returned Scholars Association. Today's China may not allow political competition, but it has opened a door to political proposal competition, he argues. The Chongyang Institute for Financial Studies, which is backed by private donors but attached to Renmin University, an elite academy in Beijing, is headed by Wang Wan, a rising star on what might be dubbed the Make China Great Again right. He downplays his rumoured access to powerful folk, insisting that Chinese leaders consult widely, gathering opinions like bees collect nectar. The institute's walls are thick with framed photographs of foreign dignitaries, for favoured think tanks also do quasi-diplomatic work. True, independence brings costs. The Unirule Institute for Economics, founded in 1993 by distinguished liberal reformers, is under siege. It currently perches in a small apartment in North Beijing down a hallway crowded with bicycles and buckets of yellowing vegetables. The government last year cancelled the business license of one of its sponsoring entities after Unirule criticised policies that favour state monopolies and hamper private firms. Authorities say its fault was hosting training courses without an educational permit. Its director, Sheng Heng, was until January a member of Chinese Economists' 50 Forum, a body closely linked to Liu He, a deputy prime minister who is Mr. Xi's chief economic adviser. Mr. Sheng says foreign members feel they are offering advice to national leaders, but access comes with invisible limitations. Too often sensitive subjects are not raised, he says. Wise emperors understood this. Diverse opinions may provoke autocratic rulers. What really hurts is the advice they never hear.
Middle East and Africa.
The Economist, March 16th to March 22nd, 2019. In the Middle East and Africa section, Kenyan politics, from frog to toady. Tanzania, a dose of bull. Education in Syria, failing, and more.
Middle East and Africa.
Kenyan politics. From frog to toady. A political bargain in Kenya has restored stability by removing the opposition.
Little over a year ago, Kenya seemed to be teetering. Swathes of the country refused to recognize Uhuru Kenyatta as their president. Nearly 100 people had died in political violence after he was declared winner of a brace of elections in late 2017. The opposition's leader, Raila Odinga, having rejected his rival's victory in the original poll and boycotted a court-ordered rerun, had declared himself the people's president. His coalition announced a plan of economic disruption and threatened the secession of opposition heartlands. With tribal animosity rising, another eruption of violence seemed possible. Then suddenly, it was all over. The two men made up in March last year. So startling has the reconciliation been after a bitter 16-year rivalry that it has taken on a fairy tale flavour. Instead of questioning the president's legitimacy, Mr. Odinga now attends rallies, funerals and church services with him, cheerleading all the way. Politicians from Mr. Kenyatta's dominant Kikuyu tribe are cock-a-hoop. Their nemesis had not been turned from a frog into a prince, thank heavens, but he had become something rather better, a toady. Fairy tales are usually heartwarming. They are also, by definition, unreal. Cold political and ethnic calculation lies behind this rapprochement. Mr. Odinga, who is 74, has concluded he will never be allowed to defeat a Kikuyu, an ally says, after losing to one in four of the five elections in which his name appeared on the ballot. Sharing power is the best he can hope for. He has won Mr. Kenyatta's backing for a referendum to increase the number of executive posts, probably by creating a prime minister and two deputies. These could be earmarked for tribes that supported the opposition, including Mr. Odinga's Luo people. Mr. Kenyatta wins too. He has tamed his opponents, restored stability, and given businesses confidence to invest. Growth has ticked up. Most crucially, the president has found an ally who could prevent his deputy, William Ruto, from succeeding him in 2022, when Mr. Kenyatta is obliged to stand down. For many Kikuyu, Mr. Ruto, a Kalenjin, represents a greater threat than Mr. Odinga. Since independence in 1963, the Kikuyu, Kenya's biggest tribe, have lost power only once, during the presidency of Daniel Arap Moi, from 1978 to 2002. Mr. Moi, a Kalenjin, curbed the clout of the Kikuyus. They do not want a repeat. The reconciliation, known in Kenya as the handshake, is not without risk. It may not last if Mr. Odinga does not get what he wants, and Kalenjin politicians are furious at what they see as a blatant attempt to shut them out of power. When the Kalenjin and Kikuyu last stood on opposing sides of the political divide in the election of 2007, some 1,400 people were killed. Many Kikuyus live in the Kalenjin heartlands of the Rift Valley. Because they, rather than their political leaders, could face Kalenjin wrath, Some are understandably nervous. The handshake also means Kenya no longer has a functioning opposition. Some fret that the country could, in effect, become a one-party state again. Few politicians seem bothered. They argue that confrontational democracy is a Western import that has endangered stability and hampered economic development. Kenya, says a close ally of Mr. Kenyatta, would be much better off with a benevolent dictatorship. Besides, the argument goes, the status quo would be little changed. Commentators sometimes point to the number of political parties Kenya has as a sign of its democratic vibrancy. Some 117 contested the election in 2007, and 47 have won seats in Parliament since the end of one-party rule in 1991. Yet Farah Maalim, a veteran MP, says he can think of only one occasion on which a serious opposition party differed in substance from the government of the day, when Ford Kenya called for widespread land redistribution in the 1990s. The rest have nearly all been temporary vehicles designed to propel their leaders to power or build ethnic coalitions. Mr. Odinga has belonged to 6 political parties, Mr. Kenyatta to 4. Between them, they have formed 5 separate alliances. Still, the lack of even a flawed opposition is troubling. In Mr. Kenyatta's first term, MPs on the other side of the House sometimes opposed bills that threatened, for instance, to impose controls on the media and non-governmental organisations. There is much less genuine scrutiny now, MPs say. Worse, the vacuum left by the opposition has been filled by government factionalism. Messrs. Kenyatta and Odinga have launched an ambitious anti-corruption drive. Powerful officials, including several cabinet ministers, have been called in to explain the suspected disappearance of funds. Yet because many of those questioned are seen as Mr. Ruto's allies, some think that the war on corruption is a ploy to neuter the deputy president. Mr. Ruto is suspected of getting his revenge by using his large parliamentary caucus to hold up government business. An attempt to rescue Kenya Airways, the unprofitable national carrier, may have stalled as a result. Plans to build houses, improve access to free health care, and boost manufacturing and agriculture have all been delayed, victims of the infighting. Such paralysis is hardly beneficial. Perhaps more worryingly, Kenya's faltering democratic progress is also in danger. Although the referendum, which could take place later this year, should broaden the ethnic inclusivity of the government, politicians could use it to weaken oversight bodies created under the Constitution of 2010. If everyone is in government, few have an interest in transparency or accountability. Moreover, there is plenty of evidence that a lack of political competition retards economic development. Many Kenyans remember the stagnation of their own one-party era. As alluring as a big tent government may seem, a jobs for all the boys political settlement is likely to foster worse governance. Every ruling party needs an opposition to keep it honest.